Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk World Radio, we are talking about Europe. Our guest, Ulrike Gerroth, is professor of political science and co-director of European Center Ernst Robert Curtius at the University of Bonn. Sort of. There are issues we will talk about. Prior to 2021, she was professor and head of the Department of European Politics and Democracy Studies at Danube University in Krems, Austria. Prior to 2016, she worked for around 25 years at European think tanks and various universities in Paris, Brussels, London, Washington, New York, and Berlin. She has been a recipient of the French L'Ordre pour le Mérite and of the Paul Watzlawick Ring of Honor and of the Salzburg State Prize for Future Studies. Ulrike Gerroth is the author of at least 18 books, including Why Europe Should Become a Republic, and including two new books in German, one called Zeitenwenden and one called Ulrike Gerroth on Halford J. Mackinder's Heartland Theory. I could go on, but let's say welcome. Ulrike Gerroth, welcome to Talk World Radio.
Yeah, I'm very happy to be with you. World Beyond War and the peace project we did. So I'm very happy to meet the people in person. I mean, in person, but at least seeing faces.
I'm very glad that you're working with World Beyond War. I'm going to be in Europe in June. Maybe we can meet in person. But I want to ask about your professorship and being fired for writing a book. Doesn't seem like appropriate treatment in academia.
Well, obviously, I was fired for plagiarism. They found tiny mistakes in a very old non-scientific book, by the way, in a non-scientific book, not in my PhD or so. And they took this as a leeway to get rid of me in a way. Yeah, so that's basically what it's about. Yeah, so for everybody who reads German, I have a website, Ulrike-Gerroth, and there is a, you know, Causa Gerroth. Many articles have been written about this. Also, by the way, in English, Thomas Fazi, who's an Italian critical journalist, just wrote a piece about it. It's on his Substack, and it's entitled State Enemy Number One, Ulrike Gerroth. And he basically details the whole story. And I think that made some noise also in the US, you know, with, you know, J.D. Vance, Twitter, freedom of speech and so people. And it has been actually translated into Persian and into Turkish and into Norwegian and into Spanish and into Russian. So there was quite a noise about this. And I'm, you know, I mean, when you're sitting in that story and you are the actor in a way, I mean, not the actor, but the protagonist, yeah, it feels really how it feels. I mean, it feels, let's say, interesting. Yeah, I mean, obviously, the legal content, and that is what now the court case is about. The legal content does not hold German laws. Yeah, so the very fact I'm trying now is I sued the university, you know, and that is now in negotiation. So I'm no longer at University Bonn. All this happened in October 22nd. So I'm the dismissal was in February. In 22nd, perhaps this, I wrote that book, Endgame Europe. And in that book, I have a lot of, you know, Maidan.
Second
and
Maidan. Meaning 2022.
22, yeah, sorry, 2022. And then this book has a chapter which is very into Maidan and the preparations of this, you know, proxy war. And then for the first time, basically, in German university history, the university openly distanced from me. And that is a novelty because I don't write books on behalf of the university. I just write books because universities present a platform where professors do research and write books, yeah, which is a difference. And obviously, in the Federal Republic, we have freedom of speech and freedom of science. And so my court case, when the university openly distanced from me, that was quite a novelty. And a couple of weeks later, I was dismissed. And so you can see a relation between the two. But obviously, the court case is about plagiarism, yeah, because they couldn't say she's writing books we don't like. So they found some
plagiarism, copying.
But you know, I mean, I have it made transparent on my website what the mistakes are. Everybody can look at it. So,
But what actually made someone think you were an enemy of Germany was what you had to say about Ukraine.
Ukraine, Gaza, Corona, a couple of other things. I mean, just putting into question current narratives on stories that are of concern for all citizens, you know. I mean, I'm a professor of political science since long. I dealt with European affairs all my life. And I'm, you know, to just say this, I'm not dissident, I'm not heretic, I'm not a state enemy. You know, as you said, I got Lord de Poulmerite of the state of France. I had a state visit with my president, Joachim Gauck, in 2013. I was in the delegation. I worked for Jacques Delors at the European Commission. I worked for Wolfgang Schäuble in former years in the 90s. So I have a very regular, perhaps, I mean, I'm a very regular German citizen. Always interested in Franco-German relations and in the European Union. It's just like that I observed that the whole system turned sour. And so I became ever more critique over the, you know, I also worked for transatlantic institutions. I was living in New York. I was at NYU. I was at Brookings. I was at the Paul and Nietzsche School. You know, I was professor. So, I mean, there is a transatlantic European policy career over 30 years. It's just like I felt since roughly 20 years, say, since Iraq War, since the European Constitution at the latest, yeah, I felt like the system turned sour. And I wrote numerous articles to say, look, we need to reform the EU. We need to think twice about transatlantic relations, this and that and this. And at some point, you get not across with your critique, and then you end up being fired. That's what I experienced.
Because democracy and freedom of speech must be defended from people speaking, I guess. Can we tell people quickly what is the Heartland theory and what would be a better theory? This is one of your new books, right?
Yeah, the book is from October 2024, and Halford Mackinder is a British geograph who had a speech in 1904 at the British Geographical Society, and there he exposed the Heartland theory. And the Heartland theory, seen from an island, the UK is an island looking on the European Eurasian continent, is in essence how a sea power, UK was a sea power, yeah, leading to World War I, how a sea power could not lose control on the Eurasian continent. I mean, how they could engage the UK, yeah. And in essence, it says that the geographical space between what is today's Ukraine up to Afghanistan, so the heartland of Ukraine, what's in the midst of this Eurasian continent, if you conquer this, you rule the world. That's the theory. Why? Because first, it's rich of resources and the whole thing, but second, because it's so into the continent that from the sea you cannot conquer this piece of land, right? So that is seen from a UK sea power perspective. And if you remember, in 1853, 57, 1857, there was already Crimea War, you know, the United Kingdom always tried to place a hand on this, you know, midst of Eurasian continent in order to control. So it didn't do much with the UK because a little after the UK lost World War II, you know, we all know the history of the 20th century. So the Heartland theory, basically the power shifted from London to Washington after World War II, say, you know, very shortly, briefly. And then what happened is that through the decades of the second half of the last century, Brzezinski especially, I mean, the Americans picked up the Heartland theory. And basically, Brzezinski wrote a book, the chess book, Grand Chess Book, in I think 96 or 97, saying that there should be a dismantling of the Russian Federation, that they need to to dig into that space, yeah. And in a way, that's the whole strategy that we saw unfolding afterwards, which is NATO enlargement, you know, always digging deeper into the heartland, into the heartland. And if you want so, and that's what I write in the book of last year, the Ukrainian war is something like the apotheosis of the Heartland Theory, yeah, because you know, because Ukraine is so central for that space. But even Afghanistan 20 years earlier was also Heartland, but just from the other side of, you know, from the east and not from the west. Yeah, so I just detailed this, and I think that's what we are experiencing, and I think that's why I'm so happy to talk to you, World Beyond War, because obviously there are many Europeans who think like this is, I mean, totally absurd that Europe forgets about its own past. First, its own past of two world, especially Germans. I'm German, yeah. Two world wars going out from German territory. We promised basically to the world that never ever we would go against the Russians again. The thing is that we had Willy Brandt, we had Egon Bahr, we had this détente politics in the 70s and 80s, we had Gorbachev, and we basically promised there should be a European security architecture with Russia, not against Russia, right? And so living today in Berlin, I'm sitting in Berlin in the year 25, feeling like my country has forgotten about its history. Europe has forgotten about its history because the EU was planned as a peace project and now turns into a war project with Mrs. von der Leyen. I feel like we are in total disruption. I think many Europeans feel like me. And yeah, I'm very happy to discuss this with you because obviously there's a transatlantic dimension. And I know many Americans from my sort of former lives when I was back and forth, Washington, New York. I'm last time in the US, I actually was in 2015, so it's quite a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, because then I focused on other things, yeah. But I think it's very important that we get that cross-Atlantic sort of peace thing ready.
We need it. Ulrike Gerold, you wrote a book that I very much enjoyed called Why Europe Should Become a Republic, which I think may be a topic a lot of people in the United States have not studied, and maybe should. What do you think's gone wrong with Europe? What was done wrong in the creation of Europe that could have been done differently or could be amended now?
So first, that's the book which is now incriminated, yeah. And they found some minor mistakes in the book. Obviously, I wrote it in 3 weeks. It's a book of 360 pages, so there are some mistakes, yeah. In which books aren't mistakes? Anyway, the legal thing now is that a scientific book or not? That's the legal question. And if you see sort of the cover where we have a sort of psychedelic, totally colorful, you know, cover, and then the subtitle is a political utopia. You would argue that a political utopia, by definition, is not scientific, right? So, just to you know, so this book is of 2016, but I had earlier articles on why Europe should be a republic. The first things I wrote about it in 2013, after the banking crisis, and when Tsipras and Varoufakis came up, and then there was this austerity and the huge sort of left. Cry out against austerity. You remember Stefan Issel, Empört euch, you know. So, and I think the banking crisis was the moment when everybody could see that the EU is sucked into a banking, whatever capitalist laundering taxpayers' money thing. I mean, there was a, I don't go into details, but the whole governance of the euro crisis was totally absurd. And you could have two options. Either we crash the euro, you know, that was the discussion, yeah. The lazy Greeks out, the lazy Italians out, yeah. And then we would have been fallen apart. Or we should have thought about some state building, yeah. Not super state. I mean, I do not want, just to say this loudly, I do not want to turn the EU into a super state, yeah. Not at all. The opposite, yeah. So I wrote the opposite. But going back to 2003, we tried a European constitution. And it was, you know, first approved, but then failed with the French no and the Dutch no. Yeah, but there was an attempt of a European constitution. And because I worked in the 90s for Jacques Delors was a trade unionist, Catholic, socialist, you know, I mean, in the 90s, the situation, the political situation was totally different. Mitterrand, Delors, and so, yeah. And so I was in this constitutional process of 2003. And when I saw the banking crisis, and I could see that the Americans, who also had this mortgage crisis, could fix their real estate crisis because you had policy. You had the Federal Reserve, you had Greenspan, and you had Obama, and you fixed the banking crisis in in 2 years, more or less. And you fired some of the bankers and it was good, right? In Europe, we couldn't do the same because we had no politics. We had a ECB, but no political, I mean, who is the counterpart? Because we have 16 finance ministers, yeah? So we ended up in a total mess. And then this chauvinism, yeah, lazy Greeks, whatever. And I felt, stop, we need to think about some state. I mean, we need to think Europe as a state, but then obviously the state needs to be social, it needs to be peaceful, it needs to be federal. I mean, little unities, decentralized. And when you go in terms of how do you call it, philosophy of thought, I mean, political philosophy, you go Platon, Aristotles, Cicero, whatever. Whenever people want to found or build a state, they call it republic. Yeah. So it's the Federal Republic of Germany, La République Française, Repubblica d'Italiana, Austrian Republic, and so on and so forth. And I said, okay, can we merge all these republics into one? Yeah. Because that would be especially not the EU and not a super state, because we would, if Europe were to be a republic, we would have citizen power, citizen participation, decentralized structure, more power of the regions, and all of that, more social structure. And so in the EU, you just have nation states deciding whatever, nobody's responsible. You have European councils, nobody knows what they're doing, no transparency, no citizens' engagement, no social policy. All of this you don't have in the EU. And so in 2016, when then Trump came and Brexit and whatever, this, and the populism for me was a reaction of a totally dysfunctional EU. So I never blamed the populists when they would say, away with the EU. I said, look, we do have a problem with the EU. I'm professor of political scientist. I mean, I know what a democracy is, now it should function, right? So I turned around the argument and I said, it's not populism the problem. The problem is the EU, and populism is a reaction. And if we want to solve it, we need to make the European Union, or not the EU, democratic. We need to build a democratic Europe, and that is why Europe should become a republic.
Right. So let me play devil's advocate and ask a question, because here I am in the United States, which is the size of a united Europe and calls itself a republic and always has. And the government is virtually non-representative of the people at all. It's representative of Wall Street, of the Pentagon, of the profiteers, of the legalized system of campaign bribery. And when we try to have a big protest in Washington, the way you can do in Rome or London or Paris or Berlin, most of the people who would come to the protest are thousands of miles away and too busy and too overworked and couldn't afford it. We have a protest of 100 people or 1,000 people in this little city that we call our national capital. But it's hundreds of miles away from any major populations and thousands of miles away from most people. And it's so darn big. How do you exercise popular control over such a government?
So, I mean, there are three things here. First, I wrote a political utopia. Yeah, I'm not sort of, I need my European Republic. In the utopian sort of sketch out, like Thomas Morus in, it's precisely 500 years after Thomas Morus. Thomas Morus was 1516, and I wrote my utopia 2016. Yeah. Anyway, so you said two things. First, we do not have citizens' participation and activism, and when you are doing demonstrations, then not enough citizens who can travel from the whole United States. I will tackle this. But before you said we have a republic, we think it's social, and in a way it's surrendered to Wall Street and sovereign capital. Yeah. In my book, at least, I tried to make a difference between the US and Europe in terms of economic traditions. Yeah. I mean, there is a huge to say, and we can't do this in 28 minutes, but in a way, you have a Rockefeller tradition and a belief system that everybody can make it. And if you don't make it, you are too lazy, whatever. Europeans have a more systemic approach. I mean, we have a tradition of workers' protests throughout centuries. We have a tradition of revolutions, a French one and a Russian one. We have also a tradition which is, in terms of spiritual, the evangelical church is more about praying for wealth, but Christianity is more about poorness, Franz von Assisi. So in my book, I argue that the very notion of republic, res publica, which is creating a political sort of body that cares for the interests of people, is more a European sort of way of thought. Yeah, I'm not saying that we realize this. We are also rendering everything to Wall Street because we are anyway rendering everything in the US hands, which for me is a pity. Yeah, so I'm not saying that isn't the case in Europe. But in a way, we have been, sorry to say this, over the last decades, a little bit perverted by the US, yeah, because much of the stuff that happened with monetarism and Milton Friedman and whatever came from you to us. Also, the real estate crisis of the banking crisis in 2007, 8, 9 came from the US. It was your mortgage policy. There is a distinct difference in political thought. And in my utopian book, I at least developed that we have a different social and economic tradition in Europe than in the US. Yeah. And that is, I think, a discussion because, in a way, we also have healthcare. We don't discuss it. We don't let people, be in the streets, the poor. There is a different thing. Yeah. And unfortunately, in my eyes, we become more American in that. Yeah. Which is unfortunate for me. Yeah. So now, in terms of participation, I agree. I mean, but look at Martin Luther King. I mean, he gathered quite a lot of people in Washington by the time. But I understand that people are too busy to don't have money, can't fly for a, yeah. So we need to think, and that is also what I try to do in my utopian book. We need to think about systems that work in a decentralized way and that can basically give back the power to the people, but decentralized. Yeah. So my utopian European Republic is all about regional, subsidiarian, participatory structures, the towns, for instance. And if you know, perhaps you know, or you can put it under this, YouTube, we did this European Peace Project. Yeah. And precisely because of that, because we didn't want to do the huge European peace demonstration on 9th of May. 9th of May is the European day that Europe is beyond war and the whole thing. So
Right.
we wanted to do a thing on the 9th of May. But instead of saying, come all to Amsterdam, come all to Barcelona, come all to whatever, Paris or Warsaw, we said, do it where you are. And we organized, and everybody can check the website, yeah, www.europeanpeaceproject.eu. So we put a manifesto in the internet, we put posters, and we said everybody can print that and download it where you are, do the thing on the same day, on the same hour in your street. And we mobilized 10,000s.
Yeah.
It was, and now we have 700 videos across the continent, from Bretagne in France to Moscow to Acropolis to Colosseum. The Europeans did it where they were. And so that's, I think, the future of participatory democracy.
Very, very good answers. I mean, I look at Europe and I see longer lifespans, greater happiness, greater health, greater environmental sustainability. I see a social support system superior to the United States. And I think, oh, the US government should learn from the European governments. Instead, I see the US spokesman, the former Prime Minister of the Netherlands, the NATO Secretary General, speaking to the European Parliament saying, take your money out of healthcare, take your money out of retirement, put your money into weapons. And I see him flying around Europe doing press conferences with each president or prime minister and them saluting this unelected Secretary General of NATO and saying, we will put 5% of our economy into weapons because democracy, when general, former general president so and so has not asked the people of Czechia or the people of Germany what they think. They just use the word democracy. So am I wrong? Do we not have everything upside down and the Europe learning the worst of the United States rather than the United States learning the worst of Europe, learning the best of Europe?
I'm sorry to say that you are right. I mean, in my opinion, too. I mean, when you say that we have the better social programs and so, the thing is, we had the better social programs. I mean, we are, look at the new coalition agreement of Mr. Merz, the new chancellor of Germany, but we are basically eroding our social capacity basically since years, and we are copying the US. And for me, that is unfortunate. Yeah. So there is, we go American. Yeah. So that's why in my last book, I basically write Europe should stop to consider itself a part of the West. I mean, the West is anyway a fiction, yeah, in cultural and in many other terms. But if Europe, as an entity, political and other, wants to have a chance of survival, it needs to go back to its own roots, the roots of its own social models. I said republic, social, and so, but the roots of its own thinking, yeah. And we also the roots of its own arts. You know, we are not Starbucks. We have Segafredo. We are not Hollywood. We have Pasolini and Chabrol. You know, there were too many years and destinies, decades in which we were told that we are part of the West, and the West was by definition American culture. And I think today there is a sort of desire. And I say this, that's by any standard anti-American. I love the United States. I've been traveling, you know, and everything with the exception of Alaska, I know in your country. I think Alaska is the only part I haven't been, yeah. But it's a wonderful country. It's wonderful citizens. So I'm not saying this in any, you know, anti-American sort of sense. It's just like there is a thing now for Europeans to reconnect with their own culture and the distinct differences between, say, American way of life and American exceptionalism and what Europe sort of has been about. To come to peace, we are in complete perversion. I mean, Europe has been, now there is new historical evidence, and we can wonder what the CIA did in any decades of the EU making, you know, and you can put into question that it has been from the beginning, whatever, an instrument for the US to finally go against Russia. I mean, there is now some historical evidence that gives us that relecture of the history of the 20th century. But I worked for Delors, and I knew Mr. Juncker and many others. So there were always in Spinelli, manifest anti-fascist, you know. So there were always engaged Europeans who really, like me, wanted a functioning, peaceful, social Europe. And that's still on the agenda. We still need to shape it. But the EU is in betrayal of the peaceful narrative of Europe. And that is why I think actually the EU will not survive, not in the way it is, because it's like for persons, you know, if you lose your integrity and you lose your root of history, you die. And I think for the, yeah, there's now so much resentment against the EU that it's something I think we, that's my thing. I have a European Democracy Lab. That's my little, you know, NGO, europeandemocracylab.eu. And that is what we do is think about two things, Europe beyond the EU and Europe fit for a multipolar world. That's the questions we have on the table. And we would love to have Americans thinking the same direction, that you also would benefit from such a Europe.
I love it, and I have a million more questions, but we're out of time. We may have to take this up again in another program. But we've been speaking with Ulrike Gerroth, whose website is ulrike-gerroth.de. Thank you for all the books you're writing, everything you're doing, and for coming on Talk World Radio.
I was very happy. Thank you so much, and greetings to the beautiful US.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.